Welcome to Extroverted Developer number 9.
Number 9.
I'm Jim Wallace.
And I'm Ben Gunderson.
All right. We are sort of sucking at getting guests this week, but we're just having a dry spell. It's cool. We'll be back in the game.
Lots of cool people want to be on our podcast.
For sure. In fact, lots of people behind us right now want to be in our podcast, but they're all playing poker.
Yes. You might call this our drunk programmer number 1 podcast.
My drunk programmer.
I'm at least a couple beers in, and we've played a few rounds of poker at City Maps this evening. We actually had a really nice sort of
celebratory
launch party.
Yeah.
Celebratory party, launch party for our newest releases this evening at the office. Also, a bunch of our business people are back from a very successful trip to South by Southwest.
And, that went really well. Got a lot of press.
Videos and presentations from that. And the mood is high here at City Maps these days, especially with the weather so nice in New York.
Yeah, absolutely. We're doing well. The press we've been getting is good. Our site has held up under the load of the additional click-throughs that we get from that, which is great for the engineering team.
Very true. Scaling is so much easier now than it used to be. There was a time when
scaling... That's
because
it's known.
Right. It's a recognized problem, but also just, cloud, Amazon, web services, all that
stuff.
That's
true. I mean, spinning up a computer, you no longer have to order it from Dell and wait for it to come in and then install it in the data center in order to scale. You just go, oh, crap, the New York Times is writing an article about us. Quick, spin up 6 web.
And there's so many more best practices knowledge on performance from Google and from everyone else who says, host these kinds of images on the CDN. Test your page with this page.
Or even just CDNs. That didn't exist.
Even CDNs.
If you needed one, you had to build one before. Right. Now that's a service.
I would guess that pages are actually faster loading now than they were even a few years ago. I think we're... just because the knowledge of how to build something fast is...
Yeah, everybody seems to be going in-memory only, NoSQL solutions like MongoDB. I don't know if MongoDB is only in-memory, but there's a lot of in-memory only like Memcache.
We're all hitting cached APIs instead of SQL-based databases. NoSQL is on the scene.
Right.
Well adopted, yeah.
So it seems like a very... well-understood problem, and that's good because then that gives you time to stop worrying about how on earth are we going to handle this incredible amount of traffic and start worrying about building your product so that it's useful to that many people, right?
Right.
And that kind of brings us to other challenges, right? One of which is I've talked a lot here about computer programmers versus the business people, which I suspect is a favorite topic of our listeners, although I have no data to back that up whatsoever.
And we also know that we talk about probably a wide variety of different technologies that you need to know to be a developer. You can't just know a single language. You have to know many languages. You have to perhaps pick up a new language every time you get a new job.
For example, you need to understand Erlang if you want to use some of the NoSQL solutions out there.
Exactly. And you have to be very familiar with JSON. You have to pick up
you need to know Objective-C if you want to program in iOS, and then your iOS talks to a back-end web service, which can be written in a handful
Any
of
language.
Languages, like a whole plethora of languages, right? Node.js is very popular now, which means that even if you didn't want to know JavaScript because you're not a client-side developer, you may need to learn JavaScript in order to work on the back end.
Right. We've hired offshore guys based purely on the merits of their knowledge of a particular framework or a particular ORM.
I think that's exactly what you want to do when you're hiring either temporary workers or contractors. You want somebody who's very specific about a technology stack. Like, man, right now we have a desperate need for Objective-C, right, or iOS development.
Sure. And everyone else.
Well, I was giving a hypothetical situation. Yeah. We actually have a good iOS developer here, Nick. And, but I wouldn't have hired a full-time employee just because they knew iOS. I think for full-time employees, we want to, I'm distracted because our CTO is taking either
taking
a video or a photo of us.
While we do our podcast.
While we do our podcast. Where was I?
But I was going to ask you, which would you prefer, a person who knows one thing very well or a jack of all trades?
It's really difficult to say. So when you're getting hired at Microsoft, they never ask you, do you know C? Do you know Java? Do you know any specific technology?
Right.
They always just test your problem-solving ability with the understanding that if you're a good problem solver,
you can figure it out.
You can learn the grammar and syntax. Right. Because as we've talked about before, grammar and syntax is largely arbitrary.
Right.
And once you learn the rules, you can apply the rules.
Yeah.
And so
this is how people can come to learn like 17 spoken languages too. Once you've learned kind of the basic structure of how, you know, grammar
yeah,
works.
It's definitely easier to learn the Latin based languages right. once you've learned Latin.
Yeah. But after you've learned three or four different languages, all languages start to come more.
Yeah, you just need to learn different types. Like you learn a procedural language, you learn an object-oriented programming language, and then maybe a functional language. And you've got pretty good, your bases covered.
Something happens in your brain at that point, right? Where it becomes easier for you to pick up new patterns because you've just experienced.
That's exactly it. You're like, this is the pattern for solving that problem. Oh, and this is the pattern in that language is just slightly different in this way, right? You're learning just the difference between the two. You're no longer learning the concept. And the concept's what's difficult, and that's why I think you need to go to school in order to get that.
And even if the languages you learned were Russian and Japanese or JavaScript and assembly language, you can still start to see the parallels and the patterns emerge.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they're very much the same. Spoken languages and computer programming languages. Very much. I used to wonder whether computer programming was more like logic, more like engineering, more like science. But the more I've done it, the more I realize that it's like writing. And I think I've said that on a podcast before. But,
sure.
But that brings the question, if it is like language, could anybody do it? Could anybody learn it just like we can learn French in high school? Can we
The Dutch
that?
Speak five languages and smoke marijuana, as Hazard famously said. So, right. I mean, and yet the Americans seem to get by well with one spoken language. Are there social or cultural constraints to learning, to being a good developer, just as there might be social...
That's a really interesting question because
advantages to learning multiple languages.
It does seem like the United States is really good at movies and programming. And those are like the two things that we export to the world that are incredible. Now there's great things that come out of the UK and out of India and other places, but it seems less often, right? It seems like it's Spotify from the UK.
Right.
And They don't break in. I know other UK developers who are now here in the States. They've got companies that are in the United States or in the UK, and they can't break into the US market for whatever reason.
Right.
And yet here we get Microsoft, Facebook, Google, Amazon, just like one after another of technology companies.
Granted, we had the kind of institutional knowledge from like the 70s and 80s when we were really the only country doing what we were doing. Mm-hmm. We had DARPA, we had we had Belt Labs, we had all these, you know. Many, many different companies and technologies that sort of we built on the shoulders of giants, as it were, and we're still building on that success.
Yeah, absolutely.
Those successes. We still
have
universities
thing about,
like Stanford and MIT that just like no one else can touch us. You know, the Chinese and Europeans, everyone sends people here
in order
to
get trained in these techniques.
Right.
Yeah.
But I mean, they'll catch up in 30 years, right? Or are you saying that there's something kind of profoundly American about programming that makes us...
Well, one theory that I heard, it seems as likely as any other theory to me, is that the reason that we're so good at movies and computer programming is it's a semi-creative endeavor where the director has a lot of control over the final product, like all creative control, where you have this one person who's dictating down the entire process. But then that would be the same for writing a book, and yet we're clearly not the world leaders in novels.
Right.
Right. And so I'm not sure where
that is. And novel writing isn't necessarily a team sport either, right? I mean, there are certainly novels that are written by two or more people, but I wouldn't say the best novels are, right? I mean,
yeah, you can totally tell when, Metatropolis was a book that was written by several people, and every chapter you can tell is a different author. Whereas with source code, when you're reading the source code, you can often tell, unless you guys can all agree on style, as to who wrote what parts of the code, except at Google, I guess, because they all have to write
teams.
In exactly the same
way.
Well,
Microsoft has different coding practices and patterns for each team, I guess, or at least each major.
Every team gets to decide on their own, and so you could easily tell code that came from the Xbox team versus code that came from the Visual Studio team.
I read a study on the development of developers, the development of how computer programmers come to be that way from an early age, and heard a statistic, and I honestly don't have a source for this at all. I you may have told this to me for all I know, that said the key attribute to being a good programmer is being able to accept arbitrary rules.
Oh, yeah. I actually got that from Jeff Atwood from a talk that he said. And apparently it comes from Stanford University. They did a study on this. where they had a lot of kids, as I'm sure that any of you who have gone to university to get a computer science degree know. It's like 150 people start out, right? Freshman year, we're all like, I'm going to be a computer engineer or I'm going to be a computer scientist. And that is not the case at the end.
Right.
And so Stanford was very curious about this incredible dropout rate in computer science, and they did a study. This is all third party from Jeff Atwood, so I don't know where Jeff got this information. But
I am one of these people. I am one of the dropouts. Jim is a success story. For example, we have two examples.
I guess in some ways I wouldn't say dropping into graphics design and then going the path that you went is necessarily
fair enough, but still
you definitely understand what we're talking about when we're talking about hardcore algorithms, data structures. You understand the limitations of dynamically linked lists and things. So
right, but the science of computer science wasn't necessary for me, certainly not the theory.
It's pretty abstract.
Right.
Yeah, I mean it's,
as it turns out in practice it was good for me, because if it's like writing or if it's like any other creative endeavor, I like to think of myself as a pretty creative person. I can think outside the box, but I mean, not necessarily as mathematically skilled as many programmers.
Right, and so that's the question: is computer programming like math? Is it like writing or anything? Right. Or are different types of computer programming like different things?
Right.
I suspect that the computer programming at Google's analytics is much more like math.
Sure.
Right. When Google is doing things like trying to figure out really difficult misspellings of words and figure out what they really meant, that's more math, right? That's Bayesian mathematics and statistics and gathering tons and tons of data.
So what was Atwood's conclusion?
Well, it wasn't Atwood. It was Stanford. And Stanford said what you just said, which is that the determining factor between success and failure of, say, freshman computer science students was an ability to just accept the rules for what they are. You don't question them. You just say, these are the rules, and I will try and play within that game as well as I can. Which when I first heard was like, bullshit.
Right.
That is not me. I do not accept the rules for what they are. I question authority all the time. And then I started thinking about the arbitrariness of any particular grammar of language. And I was like, oh, yeah, totally.
And how did they make those decisions in the first place, right? Like, when Dennis Ritchie was designing C, how did he decide on, the curly brace,
right? Totally arbitrary. Yeah. It could have been pipe.
He liked the way it looked. Yeah. Like, whatever. Yeah.
Could have been open paren. It could have been anything.
Who cares?
Right? But now it's curly brace, and we all can't imagine a world without curly braces denoting code blocks. But that was probably totally arbitrary.
Yeah. And now it's on T-shirts.
And in our logo.
Oh.
Yeah. So. And so when it comes to that level, like understanding and learning the language, where you're just like, okay, I want to learn this language, be it French, be it German, be it C or Java, you just have to say, okay, I'm going to learn the rules for how to express my ideas as best as possible and try and apply them and not question that, why is it else space if, right?
Yeah, because if you ask why too often, I mean, it's turtles all the way down, right? You can keep asking until you can keep asking until there are no more answers, but because it is, because someone made it that way.
Right. It's like talking to an adult as a little child. Why is the sky blue? Why all the way down? Even if you can explain, that's going to be fun.
Why is it explode in PHP?
Why is it explode and not split?
Because they're French.
Because they're French. Oh,
man. Yeah. But if you're not able to make those connections, right? If you're not able to, if you're someone who does have to ask why, or someone who is too strict or constrained about those rules, maybe you make a very bad computer programmer. Maybe accountants don't make good computer programmers, even if they're good at certain kinds of math. Maybe, I don't know.
Maybe not. So, this is a constant struggle. It's like, I wonder, I'm sure other computer programmers who are listening to this have often thought, I can do that business thing, right? These guys can't possibly do the incredible amount of math that we had to go through. I mean, three levels of calculus and then discrete math and then linear algebra and like all of this abstract problem solving was hard. Yeah. And many of us, the common thing that I hear when I talk to other engineers who've come out of college is like, we went to one of every three parties in college, right? We didn't get to go to all the parties because we were in the lab.
One out of three was great.
Yeah, if you could get one out of three, it meant it was probably your senior year.
Yeah. That was in the summertime.
Right. And it's just like computer programming, computer science is an incredible amount of work. And when you see people from other majors who are at more parties than you because they're not in the lab on Thursday night and they don't have class on Friday at 8 a.m. because the professors in engineering, right, for some reason love 8 a.m. classes.
Right.
Their professors may have spoken English as well. And so for all of this, it kind of builds up this resentment and it makes you wonder. It's like, okay, maybe I chose wrong. Yeah. Maybe I should have been a major.
Are you just good at political science because you're particularly social and that lends itself to meeting other people
who are interested in
politics? Or are you only good at English?
Right. Could I have been a poli sci?
Right. How much is your MBA really worth? Right.
Right. And sometimes that's the resentment that winds up coming out of computer, like the incredible amount of hard work we do. And then we go into the world and there seems to be an imbalance between.
Right. Or at least there's too many people who say, oh, well, you know, if I just went back to school for a couple of years, I could also be a programmer.
Right. And the reason that we're sort of talking about this is that there have been a couple of interesting articles that have argued that everybody should become a computer programmer. I mean, it sort of started with Forbes said that every company is a software company and they all need computer engineers and computer programmers. But as recently as Marketplace, I think it was a couple days ago, like on Wednesday or something, there was this article from Farhad Manju on Marketplace arguing that every employee of every company needs to learn how to code. Right. No matter what you do, whether you're a secretary, whether you're an accountant, you need to learn how to code in order to do two things. One, keep your job because that's all being automated incredibly quickly and you don't realize it. Or two, even if it's not a matter of keeping your job, maybe you have some job that, you know, can't lend itself to code.
And we're not against this at all. I mean, I'm certainly not against other people learning how to code or trying to learn how to code. It's just a question of can everybody code? Yeah. And once you've kind of gotten yourself acquainted with the basics, should you like continue down the path of trying to be someone who writes code?
So it does seem like everybody can write in the sheer number of volume of books that are out for sale. Sure. I mean, there's more books available today than have ever been available in the history.
America's Sarah a place Palin is 99.something% literacy, right? We can all read, we can all write, but should we all write?
Right. That's the question. I didn't mean to call out Sarah Palin. I haven't read her book. I don't know whether it's good or bad. I also don't know whether she wrote it.
I know she's not a very good public speaker.
Right. And so it's like, should she also write a book? Should I write a book? Probably not. I've dabbled. Right.
But that doesn't mean you shouldn't learn or, you know, at least try and see if you would enjoy it. And maybe, you know, and if you enjoy it, maybe it's something you should continue to
Try. What I think it comes down to is evidence. Right. There's no, it's very difficult to say, oh, I could have been a business major or for the vice versa. I could have been a computer programmer. It's easy to say that and to even feel that that's true.
Right.
But I think that if you say I could have been a writer, okay, well, where's your writing? Right. You can't say I could have been a writer and never have written anything. Right. There's more evidence if you say I could have been a writer. Oh, and here I've tried to write some things. Now at least I've got some data that shows that I could have in fact been a writer.
Did anyone buy your books?
Did anyone buy my books? Right. Or
I mean, it's not
even if I just wrote them and didn't sell them.
You don't have to be a bestseller to be a good writer. But if you can make your living from doing nothing but writing, I think it's safe to say that that's a good indication that you're a
good
writer.
That you could have been a writer. Right?
Or that you are a good writer. Like, yeah. I don't know what good or excellent or genius writing necessarily is, but if you make your living doing nothing but writing novels, and that is your job, and you support yourself
but even
and your family,
less, yeah. I but think I'm saying even less than that. I can't even finish a book. What I'm saying is like write out a start, a middle, and an end and have an end and be like, this is a book and a complete story. And what, regardless of whether I get paid for it or not as a professional, I'm not even sure that I could do that. And I've tried. I've tried writing out a story and I'm like, holy crap, this is hard.
Yeah.
And so to say that you can be a computer programmer without ever having written a complete program, there's no data that shows that you can be a computer programmer. Now, the same is like, oh, I could have been a business major. Well, then try and start a business. Now, I have. I've started two businesses and failed at both. So maybe there's some indication there that I can't. But there's more data that shows that I've at least gone down this track. And so that's sort of where my argument lies about the hypothetical. It is very difficult to know whether or not somebody could be a computer programmer.
Right.
But you can test that hypothesis.
And a business, and like, I guess at least a computer science degree, or I guess in some cases an art degree, means that you have a portfolio. It means that you've written complete programs, right? A business degree doesn't necessarily mean that you've started a business. Although, I don't know.
That would be a good indication.
I'm sure
there's a business plan. How about that?
Actually, I think there are some business schools that do require you to form your own LLC and do some basic paperwork and things like that. But not certainly not every business school. I definitely know a few people with MBAs who have never owned their own business or
done their own. I think that's fair, right? I think they did the forming the LLC, they did the business plan, they did all that stuff in school. I did that for the computer programming side. I wrote a tree sort algorithm. I wrote like all these working programs. And so I think those are equivalent. Yeah, I'm with you on that. So I'm not saying that somebody who came out of business school can't be a business person. That is, they can be for sure. They've done all the work. They've proven all of that.
Right.
What I'm saying is that without the work, you can't prove that you could change careers. Right?
Sure.
I can't be a singer unless I can sing a song from beginning to end.
right.
And you can show that without getting a whole degree. Right? We don't have to necessarily go back to school and get a computer science degree. I think that there's lots and lots of self-taught computer programmers out there who were fine arts majors or who were art history majors or whatever, and they got into a job and they started to discover that they liked programming, or they somehow stumbled into it and taught themselves Visual Basic, or they taught themselves some web programming, and now that is what they do. Perfectly valid. Yes, those people can be computer programmers, right? And so they've proven that they can do it. My intolerance comes from when I think people have gone to 3 parties when I could only go to 1, then turning around without any evidence and telling me that they could be a computer programmer. And I'm like, no.
I read an article in a writing writer's blog that essentially said, if you can make your living as a writer, then you are by definition, or at least by as good a definition as someone can come up with, that you are a good writer.
Mm-hmm.
It means that enough people are willing to read your writing and pay money for it that you can consider yourself good. It doesn't necessarily mean you're great. It doesn't mean that you should be remembered throughout the ages as a classic. It just means that you are a good writer.
Yeah.
If enough people will pay you to read your stuff, right? And I can get behind that. Does the same go for computer programming, or I guess a lot of other things? Like if you can write
a computer program and then have
if you can make your living at computer programming, are you
you're a good computer programmer?
Are you then a good computer programmer?
It's an interesting question. I don't know.
If you can support a family on what you make as a computer programmer, does that make you good at it?
You're definitely good enough to get paid. Yeah.
Certainly. Definitely enough to get paid more than once, I suppose.
More than once, that's true.
More than once by multiple
that's
different
an important
people.
Thing.
Right. Granted, you're probably being paid by people who aren't computer programmers and so aren't necessarily the best judges of it, but they're at least judges of the product you create.
Example would be, now there's so much self-publishing these days for both the publishing world. Like, you can write an Amazon single. Same thing has always been true of computer programming. If you write an FTP client, you can turn around and sell that tiny component, right? And make money off of that. And so let the market decide. That's it. That's a great idea. I love this idea. Let the market decide who's a good and bad computer programmer.
Yeah. We're in an interesting stage, I think, technology's in an interesting point in, I guess, the world in which we live that may make that not necessarily true, though, right? There's got to be enough people out there who aren't good programmers, who are responsible for paying programmers.
You mean computer programmers who are not good but are still getting paid, and the people paying them just don't know the difference?
Yeah, I mean, there's people out there who are paying programmers who don't know the difference between good and bad programming, and so they're just paying regardless.
But I think the same could happen in any profession. Good and bad carpenters, good and bad writers, good and bad
people buy bad books all the time, don't they?
They Twilight. Do. Trashy romance Twilight. George McKay.
Yeah. But I guess it's fair to say, I agree with you, that if you can support yourself at a particular profession, then it's all right to call yourself good at that thing. Or at least, not at least mediocre. I don't know.
I'll let the market continue to decide.
Yeah.
Hopefully,
fair enough. I'm
for the
free market on that one.
Yeah. Hopefully the cream rises to the top. Although, Steve something, the guy who wrote Code Complete, lives in Seattle. He actually started the 10x programmer hypothesis because of this. He felt like he was a much better computer programmer than anybody else. This is a recent blog post that he wrote. Sure. And if I can find it, I'll put it in the show notes. He felt that he was a much better computer programmer, up to 10x better than the people around him. But he was not making 10 times the pay. At most, he was making 2 times the pay.
Yeah.
And so he was like, well, why is this? And he sort of made it his life's goal to figure this out. And he's like studied computer programming effectiveness and things like that in order to try and understand this. Now, there's lots of discrepancies in pay. There's lots of problems and discrepancies with pay. Like some people are willing to be 5 times better in productivity output, but only get paid twice as much because there's something about being the best in your office. Right, being the very best computer programmer there, as opposed to going to some place where you could make more, but you're no longer the best.
Yeah.
Right?
Or there's the fact that perhaps it's not possible to find a job in which you get paid 10 times what you're making now, even if you are 10 times better than everyone around you.
No, the point is not 10 times what you're making now. It's 10 times is the worst.
Oh, 10 times the
worst. It's all relative, right? It's you make 10 times as much money as the worst programmer at your company. Which is very difficult to determine, right? How do you determine quality? Is it lines of code? Is it number of bugs? Is it number of features divided by the bug time? Like, I mean, you can come up with any metric, and that metric can be gamed by a smart computer programmer. And Joel Spolsky has said that like a billion times. Basically, metrics don't work on computer programmers because they're too smart and they will game whatever metric you give them.
And that's a human thing, too. I mean, once there's a system out there to be gamed, then people will game it.
Yeah. I am very happy, though, to see good explanations for what it takes to become a computer programmer coming out of things like Extra Credits, which is this video game, like about the video game industry, sort of very hardcore about the video game industry. But there are a couple of the more recent ones are, so you want to be a computer programmer for the game industry.
Are they like these stick figure animation type?
They're animated drawings where the guy talks really quickly. They're about 5 minutes in length, but they go really deep into very deep topics about game mechanics and game design and things like that.
Very cleverly written, I think.
Very well written. And they got the people over at gamedev.stackexchange to help out with that information for those episodes. And they're very comprehensive. They're so comprehensive that I'm like, ooh, there's some areas there that I am not even familiar with that they're like, you must know these in order to become a game programmer. I knew most of it.
Right.
But there was like 2 or 3 areas that I'm like, I'm not that good in that area. I know that.
Right. And we'll link to this in the show notes. But yeah, there's a whole series. So you want to be a developer. And I guess we've been kind of talking about like so you want to be a computer developer, should you?
Yeah.
Perhaps.
So that's the one set is, do you want to be a computer programmer? And if you do, can you do it?
Right.
And this alludes us to a future show that we're going to have, which is, once you've become a computer programmer and you decided that this is not for you, what happens then? Where do you go?
Sure.
And we're going to have a special guest on the 25th of March to talk about
next week.
Yeah, nice. To talk about careers after programming, and look forward to that. Stay tuned.
Yeah, I'd heard it said once that you have to try a thing 3 times to know if you want to do it, and that's like the first time is to get over the fear of doing it, the second time is to learn how to do it, and the third time is to find out whether you like to do it or not. Like you can't even know whether you enjoy something.
I never have the fear.
Times, right?
I'm the best at something the first time I do it, and then I get progressively worse from there.
Fair enough.
And then I come back up. I'm like a U.
Right. I mean, I guess that could be true for things. You know, you could go skydiving, and the first time you probably aren't learning much. You're just following someone's instructions, and they push you out of a plane, and you're like, okay, now I've done it. And the second time, you're actually, you know,
paying attention.
You've done it, so you're paying attention, and then you learn sort of the general rules, and you're like, okay, all right, I think I remember this time. And the third time, you're like, all right, did I actually enjoy that? And after the third time, you're like, okay, that sucked. Maybe I shouldn't do that again. Expensive lesson, right?
Unfortunately, for some people, the first time is high school, the second time is college, and then the third time is their first job where they realize they actually hate it.
Right. And by the time they're done with their first job, they're like, wait, this is all I've ever done throughout high school, college, and my first job. I'm 35, and oh, God.
This happens in other professions. I know one of my friends went and got his finance degree, graduated second in his class, went into finance and found out that he hated it, only to go become a lawyer and then go all the way through law school and decides he hates that. I feel so bad for him, but he is now a lawyer trying to pay off the student loans. And I'm just like, oh, yeah. Poor Steve.
Student loans.
Yeah. All right. I think that's all we have for this podcast.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it.
All right. But,
yeah.
Another
exciting stuff next week.
Yeah, next week.
Yeah. Podcast.
Yay.